Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Good Health Cafe, the place to learn about how to navigate the healthcare system and understand health in plain language. I'm your host, Nikita Boston Fisher, a health educator with a passion for meeting people where they are. Today's guest is Ms. Eliane Dion. Eliane is a practicing pediatric occupational therapist who works in the province of Quebec while concurrently completing her doctoral studies. She came to the cafe to discuss what occupational therapy is, how to choose the right occupational therapist, myths surrounding the profession, and the impact her PhD research can have on practice. Grab your warm drink and tune in for a great conversation. Hi, Eliane. Welcome to the Good Health Cafe. Thank you so very much for coming. Could you please introduce yourself to the audience?
Hi, Nikita. Well, first, thank you for having me. It's always a wonderful opportunity to have the possibility to discuss both my clinical work as an OT, but also my research on a public platform like yours, so that more people are made aware of the power of occupational therapy. So my name is Eliane. I'm an occupational therapist, or OT. I've been an OT for 6 years now, always working in pediatrics in the private sector out in Gatineau. I've also been pursuing my doctoral studies at the same time, looking at the academic implications of motor coordination disorders in children. So I find I'm in a wonderful position where I can both benefit from my clinical work and my research work and kind of use both in the same direction, in the sense that my research is putting me in a position where I know a lot about what's coming out in the research, the literature that's coming out, and everything that's kind of up to date with regards to my clients. And at the same time, seeing clients in clinical work is also feeding my research interest and keeping me grounded into my research. So I'm really at the forefront of both areas of my field, I should say. And I'm really enjoying this at the moment.
That's wonderful. It sounds like you're keeping yourself very busy. Can you tell us, please, what is an occupational therapist? What do occupational therapists do?
Absolutely. That's a great question because a lot of people do not know what occupational therapy is. So occupational therapy is a rehabilitation professional, same as physiotherapists, audiologists, speech language pathologists. And our main goal is really just to help people participate and perform in their activities of daily living. Now, activities of daily living is a term in occupational therapy that we use a lot, but basically it refers to anything that you might do in your life on a daily basis. So activities such as, you know, being able to participate in work activities, being able to do anything that you're doing at home, socializing, taking care of your children if you're an adult. But in the case of children specifically, it's also participating in school activities, making friends, extracurricular activities as well, such as biking, swimming, and all other things related to life. So it's a very wide definition, but hopefully an occupational therapist really just wants to help those people to support their clients to participate in a meaningful way in their activities of daily life.
Can you give us an example, please? What a challenge would be that someone might have and how the occupational therapist can aid with that?
Yes, absolutely. So biking, especially in children, is a very good example. I see a lot of children that have motor coordination difficulties, and their issues are actually the reason why they come into occupational therapy. And initially, you might think that, for example, a 9-year-old child who's unable to bike would only have that sole implication in their life of not being able to bike. But rather, not being able to bike also means that you might not go to the playground with your friends and that you might not be able to socialize or go see your friends at their houses over the weekend, for example. And so this child may be maybe more isolated than other children. And so working on that by those biking abilities will be particularly useful, not just for their motor skills, but also for their generic development overall.
That's quite interesting. How did you get interested in this field?
Yeah, that's a great question as well, because as I said, not a lot of people know what occupational therapy is unless they've come to see an occupational therapist or have interacted with one of them in their life. In my particular case, I knew what occupational therapy was from a very young age because my mother is actually an occupational therapist. So she has also been working with children, and we're actually working alongside sometimes nowadays.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
So your mom was an occupational therapist, which helped you to learn about the field. And I suppose by observing her and the things she did, you thought, oh, that's a path that I want to explore.
Yes, definitely. And actually, occupational therapy for her was also something that she would bring home in the sense of her, you know, her lenses or how she saw us, her children, and how she interacted with us as well. And I kind of really liked that approach. And it made me not only knowledgeable about occupational therapy, but also kind of curious to see, well, what is that field of occupational therapy where you can basically help anyone with any condition, no matter their age, their cultural background, their context in life. It made me very curious to know how I could actually be one of those people and help out the people around me as well. So that's how I got into occupational therapy at first.
So how does someone know if they need the services of an occupational therapist?
So anyone who's encountering difficulties in the activities of their daily life could benefit from seeing an occupational therapist. In my particular case, like I said, I work in pediatrics. So a lot of the references that I'm seeing are from children who are having trouble with, for example, biking, handwriting at school. That's a very common one. They might also have attentional difficulties, sensory difficulties, executive functioning difficulties, socialization difficulties, and these will have impacts on their home life, their school life, their routines, their homeworks, any activity in which they're participating daily.
Do referrals normally come from a provider, for example, a pediatrician, or is this something that parents figure out on their own? Because as I'm listening to you and the problems, the challenges that occupational therapists treat, some of them sound to me almost like things that you might see in your life daily and dismiss. So you might think, oh, well, that's just his personality or maybe her coordination is off, but it might not occur to somebody that we could actually fix this, you know?
Absolutely. So usually we see people when these difficulties become meaningful to them. So you might encounter a difficulty in your daily life that will have a very limited impact, maybe because you don't participate in that activity on a frequent basis, or maybe because it's just something that's unimportant to you, right? If you're having trouble doing Sudokus, for example, but you're never doing them, it doesn't matter. It doesn't have a meaningful impact on your life. But when it has a meaningful impact, meaning, for example, that it's impacting your school life or your work life, if you're an adult, then that becomes something that you might want to work on and therefore seek out the services of an occupational therapist. In pediatrics, the referrals, to get back to your question, they mostly come from either the pediatricians or the teachers. We have a lot of referrals that are coming from the school system because any attentional, motor, executive functioning, learning difficulties are usually going to be identified first by a teacher. And then the teacher will make that parent aware of what they're observing. They'll say, well, you know, maybe you should either consult with your medical doctor or you should try and see if you can get some occupational therapy services. What I've seen in my particular practice is that because I work very closely with schools and teachers, once I'm involved in a particular school or with a particular teacher, what happens is that these people discover the power of occupational therapy, as I like to say it. And then they kind of realize, well, you know, I have other children in my classroom that might benefit from this. Or I know of another kid who might have a similar profile as to the one that we're working with right now. And so it's a little bit by word of mouth that teachers, directors, resource specialists, right, end up knowing about occupational therapy and kind of identifying the kids or the children that might benefit from our services.
What types of questions should parents ask if their child needs to see an occupational therapist? So, for example, a child is referred to an occupational therapist and the parents go, how do they know if this is going to be a good fit?
Yeah, it's actually a great recommendation to ask parents to find an occupational therapist that will have a good fit with their child. So naturally, in my particular case, I usually speak on the phone with the parents before I even set up a first appointment, just because first I need to know a little bit about what their request is before I schedule the first appointment, just to make sure that I'm really the professional that can help them and that I know a little bit of what we're going to be doing during that first session. So that interview on the phone is a really great moment for parents to ask questions about what is it that I can do for them. Parents might want to ask questions with regards to experience, for example. I would recommend, if you're looking for an occupational therapist for your child, to have an occupational therapist who's doing pediatrics, of course, right? Occupational therapists work with a variety of clients, conditions. And so you want to make sure that you've found an occupational therapist who not necessarily specializes, but at least has a little bit of experience working in pediatrics, in the educational system, and in collaboration with caregivers as well. So experience is definitely one. I would also recommend asking about the type of services or the availability of the occupational therapist. Depending on the situation, it might be beneficial for a child to receive their services in a clinic, at home, or even at school.
Oh.
Yeah. So that's something that a parent might want to ask is, well, our issue is mostly school-based or home-based. So you can ask the occupational therapist, is it something that you do to just come into our home and help us do something that's going to be really targeted, really specific to our context?
That's brilliant.
Yeah, that's something that I really recommend, because it's really going to help direct the type of occupational therapist that you're selecting, but also the type of services that you're going to be able to receive. What we know in terms of literature is that the more significant, the more real life the occupational therapy service is, the more it's going to be transferable and the more you're going to see impacts in your daily life. If there are issues with biking, for example, well, I have the parents directly bring the child's bike to a park nearby. We don't do this in my office. Yeah. Not because of lack of space, but rather because it needs to be a real life thing. If I'm only practicing biking with a child in front of a TV or in a virtual reality setting, it's not going to have the same implications or the same learning process as if we were doing it in a park with their own bike, with their parent holding the back of the seat a little bit.
Right.
So the more real life based it is, the stronger your impact is going to be. So that's something that caregivers might want to take into consideration when they're looking for an occupational therapist.
Those are all really great suggestions. Is occupational therapy, given that you sometimes work on issues of coordination, is this the type of treatment or experience where you might leave with exercises to do or practice at home?
Yes, definitely. What I particularly like to do is to involve the parents or the teachers or sometimes other professionals as well in my sessions. So this way, the adults that are surrounding this child on maybe a daily basis, or at least more frequently than I do, can really understand what is it that we're doing and how they can transfer that information and that kind of approach into what they're doing daily with the child. So it won't necessarily take the form of a homework in the sense that I rarely provide like worksheets to do at home, but I will rather make sure that the parent or the teacher has the understanding and the knowledge and the tools required for them to reproduce the kind of setting that I'm doing with the child in their home, in their classroom or whatnot.
Ah, very interesting. Are there any myths or misconceptions that you think need to be dispelled about occupational therapy or working with an occupational therapist?
Yeah, that's a really great question, because actually I find that there's a lot of myths with occupational therapy, mostly probably because people don't know about occupational therapy, right? The first one, and that's the one that I've probably heard most frequently throughout my career yet, is that a lot of people, when I explain my role, will say like, oh, that's great, because I thought occupational therapists only adapted workspaces. Yeah, so occupational therapists have kind of that reputation where we only adapt workspaces and make sure that your chair is at the right level and that your computer and your screen is at eye level and that you've got the perfect physical environment for an adult to do their work. And it, if you're looking at this, the origin of the words in French it's ergothérapie, which is very close to ergonomie. That might actually explain part of why people are getting confused with that definition. So people think this is what all occupational therapists do, but actually it's a very, very, very small part of the role of an occupational therapist. And it's actually never been my role because I don't work with adults. I don't do back to work transitions. I only work in pediatrics. Of course, I've adjusted tables and chairs to make sure that the proper setting is in place for the child to participate in my sessions or for the child to be sitting down in their classroom. But obviously, I don't spend 10 sessions doing that, right? It's a matter of a few minutes, just making sure that we've got the right setting. Because of course it is important, but it's really not the extent of where I go as an occupational therapist. So that's definitely a big myth that I hear a lot. And when the caregivers understand what is it that an occupational therapist can do and the vast role that we can take on, when we start talking about maybe sleep or hygiene and stuff like that, a lot of parents will go like, oh, this is great. And a lot of them realize like, oh, I could use you for a lot of things then.
Now, tell me about sleep. How can an occupational therapist help with sleep?
Absolutely. So sleep is a big one, or maybe not a big one, but a more have an on the up and rising themes of occupational therapy. But definitely an occupational therapist can help a lot with the routines that are surrounding sleep, right?
Oh.
The reason why someone might have difficulty sleeping can be very varied. It can be because of sensory issues. It can be because of anxiety, self-esteem. It can be because of the context of the room. It can be because of the strategies that you're using when you wake up at night. So there's a lot of analysis that an occupational therapist can do about why is it that you're having trouble sleeping. And then from there on, design strategies that are personalized and adapted to your context to really focus on getting you to be able to sleep. Because people don't realize, but sleep is actually like a third of your day. And it's the activity that you spend the most time during your day doing, right? So yeah, it's one of them that's very rare to have a referral in pediatrics for sleep. But when we ask those questions, oftentimes we realize, oh, okay, this is not just a child who's having attentional difficulties, but it's also a child who's, for example, having difficulty following the routine at night because of their attentional difficulties. And then it's also having an impact on their sleep.
I suspect adults might want help with that too. That sounds like a pretty general one.
Absolutely. And I mean, that's why there's occupational therapists working with children, teenagers, adults, older adults. Because everyone can encounter difficulties with sleep at any point in their life, right? So yeah. An occupational therapist can be the professional to give you a hand.
That is good to know. So why don't you tell us about your research work now? Tell us, what are you researching and why are you researching it?
Absolutely. So I'm researching the academic implications of a specific motor condition, which is called developmental coordination disorder. It's also often called motor dyspraxia. And it's a condition in which children will have difficulty performing motor tasks. So they have motor coordination issues, motor planning issues as well. And oftentimes these children will have difficulty with handwriting in the first few grades of school. They will have trouble biking, trouble tying their shoelaces, trouble using a spoon or a fork. Oftentimes they've also encountered some delays in their developmental milestone. For example, they've walked a little bit on the late side. They didn't necessarily walk on all fours, right? They didn't do some crawling. So they have some indicators usually in their developmental sequence. But mostly when I see them, they're older than 5 years old-ish, and they will have difficulty with motor coordination issues. Now, the occupational therapist is particularly able to participate in the diagnostic process for developmental coordination disorders, which for easier purposes, I will call DCD, which is the abbreviation. And in the case of children with DCD, what we're realizing is that not only do they have motor issues, but they also encounter learning difficulties. So because a lot of the learning process in school is done through motor activities, so for example, either handwriting or manipulating blocks and items to count, they will have difficulty accessing those learning opportunities. And so they will have a delayed start in terms of anything that's related to writing. Yeah. Oftentimes reading as well, because they have to coordinate the movement of their eyes to be able to follow the lines and read the information that's in front of them on the page. And in terms of mathematics, it's mostly because the first access you have to math is to manipulate things, right? To hold, I don't know, little sticks and count them, right? To move them on your table and see how many there are. So these are all motor activities. And when you have motor coordination challenges, it's going to be really hard to access those learning opportunities. So my research is specifically looking at what are the academic implications of DCD and how is it that we have mathematical difficulties in children that have motor coordination issues. And one of the things that we've highlighted is that the visual perception component is a very important one. So for example, if you're trying to catch a ball, you're going to need to be able to see the ball in space. You're going to need to be able to perceive the depth, the speed at which that ball is coming towards you in order to prepare for the motor activity, which is catching the ball. So oftentimes, a lot of children who have DCD will have trouble with that initial portion of visually analyzing what's going on. In the context of academic tasks, they encounter the same kind of issues, right? Where they have to look at the page in front of them or the problem or the worksheet or the exercise, and they have to look at it and they have to analyze it. They have to decide, where is it that they're going to write on the page? Are they going to use a color? Are they going to do a drawing to represent what's happening? And all of these things are visually based. And so children with DCD have one of the theory of the mechanisms of DCD is they have visual perceptual difficulties. And that leads to both motor coordination issues and mathematical challenges. So that's the stepping stone in which we can find a common point between the motor coordination portion and the math.
That's very interesting. And once your results are available, how will that help children who are suffering with DCD?
I'm so glad you're asking that. So the first three parts of my thesis were really focused on what are the academic implications? What does that mean for math? And then how does the visual perceptual component drag into all of this? And now the last portion of my thesis is actually a survey that was sent to all pediatric occupational therapists throughout Canada to identify what is it that they're actually doing to support these children at the moment. So by doing that survey, we're hoping to get the information as to where is it that we need to provide additional support to occupational therapists? What kind of knowledge do they need to be able to support these children? And what is being done and how can we improve on that? So we expect in our results, and I'm actually working on that at the moment to do that data analysis. What we're seeing is that a lot of occupational therapists are not addressing those core issues of learning. They're working on the biking, on tying the shoelaces, holding the utensils, but the academic portion is kind of set aside a little bit. For different various reasons, not because occupational therapists are unable to do it, but rather because there are systemic barriers. There are barriers of knowledge. There are barriers of access. There are barriers. There's a ton of barriers. And by doing that survey, we're hoping to identify those barriers and help occupational therapists be better equipped to support children with DCD in all of their activities of daily living, including academic activities.
Excellent. So at the end of it, you'll have a vast swath of data that will ultimately help children with DCD get better and more efficient care, it sounds like.
Yeah, more efficient, more targeted as well onto their difficulties. And to get to a point where mathematics is not, you know, my ideal goal is that mathematics is not that dark school subject that no one wants to talk about anymore. Right? That's the first impression I get whenever I'm talking about this. People are like, well, why math? We don't care about math. Once you're done grade school, you know, you don't have to do math anymore. But that's so not true.
I think you'll also have a legion of math teachers who are very happy about your work so that they have children come to the classroom with a more positive attitude.
Absolutely. And I mean, teachers, neuropsychologists who are doing this work, speech language pathologists as well. There's an army of people to support. This is not just me saying this. There's an army of people around me saying this as well, but it needs to be more on the public place. It needs to be talked about. There needs to be strategies implemented at the governmental level as well. Right now, adaptations that are available in school in the Quebec curriculums are very vast in terms of writing and reading. But in terms of mathematics, there's very limited access to strategies and resources and adaptations. So we need to do better as a society in math because we're using math a lot in our daily lives. And the more the technological tools are being developed and the more we're using those tools in our daily lives, the more we're going to need mathematics.
You mentioned that the system level changes are needed for some of these things. Until those changes occur, how can parents help their children to avoid falling through the cracks as they navigate these systems?
Yeah. Unfortunately, at this point, I find that the best way to not fall through the cracks is to request help from the private sector, unfortunately. Right now, particularly children with DCD who have learning implications of their medical diagnosis are falling between the cracks of the health system and the educational system. Because on the one side, the health system is saying, well, you know, you're talking about handwriting difficulties and math difficulties, and we don't do this in health. But then the educational system is saying, well, you know, we don't have the tools to help children with DCD because DCD is a medical diagnosis. So the children that have DCD are kind of already falling through the cracks because no one is able or has the context or the support in the public sector to be able to give them a hand with that. Of course, there are some exceptions, right? There are some cases where you have occupational therapists that are hired by the centre de service scolaire, the school systems, or the school directly, and they're providing that support that these children need. But more often than not, they're falling through that particular crack between the health and the educational system, and they need to appeal to the private sector, the privately funded occupational therapists, to be able to get those services as well.
How do you get that initial diagnosis of DCD?
DCD is usually diagnosed in collaboration with an occupational therapist. Oftentimes, again, the referral will come in from either a teacher, or actually the teacher or the pediatrician or the family doctor will speak with the parents and say, oh, I'm seeing some issues. I'm aware of DCD for X, Y, Z reason, possibly working with a child who has had DCD before. And from there on, they inform the parents that they should be on the lookout for an occupational therapist. And once they come and see me, I'll proceed to an evaluation. I'll evaluate their motor skills. I'll evaluate the motor skills opportunities that they've had as well. We'll take in consideration their age, their gender, any other condition that they may have, attentional difficulties, medications, sensory profile. And all through that, we'll be able to identify if a particular child is having a significant motor skills delays. And if so, then confer with the pediatrician or the family doctor to have them confirm a diagnosis of DC.
That's good to know. I have to say, I really love your description or your explanation of the falling through the cracks question, because you showed that link between the education system and the health system and how those two intersect. And that's really interesting. So thank you for bringing that example out. As we wind down, is there anything that you haven't mentioned that you think we should mention that people should know about occupational therapy, working with an occupational therapist, or anything like that?
Maybe one of the things that we haven't talked about a lot at this point is mental health. So occupational therapists do physical health, but also mental health. So in my case, obviously, with children with DCP, they will have mental health implications. Oftentimes, it's just using the phrase mental health will sometimes be a trigger for some people, mm-hmm. or will make it harder to access some different services. But whenever we see implications of anxiety, poor self-esteem, that's where we can directly call that mental health issues, right? And so an occupational therapist, by their work through the meaningful activities of daily life, will also have a positive impact on mental health. So anyone struggling with either physical or mental health issues could possibly benefit from seeing an occupational therapist, especially if they have, particularly in the context of having any daily life activities that they want to get back to. Typical example would be an adult that's suffering from depression who's having trouble getting up in the morning and getting dressed, or having any trouble doing any chores during their day, right? If you're having trouble doing what you need to be doing during your day, maybe consulting with an occupational therapist would be a good idea. And like any other professional, if you're not sure about whether or not you should be seeing an occupational therapist for yourself or for someone else around you, a good thing is always to ask some questions. Contact an occupational therapist and ask, say, I'm encountering this issue. Could you possibly help me with that? Some occupational therapists do mostly assessments, though others will do mostly intervention, sometimes a mix of both. The idea is if you're encountering issues, don't just stay on your own with them. There are people out there who are able to help you, who are able to give you the tools to make your life more significant, more positive, more meaningful. You just have to do the first step and get those services for yourself. And don't ever underestimate the power of an OT.
I love that admonition for people to ask questions, to advocate for themselves. I think it's really interesting that you mentioned mental health. I'm glad that you did. In the beginning, when I asked you some of the things that occupational therapists can help with, one of the things you said was making friends. And I thought, that is so interesting. Is that why there's therapy in part of the title? Because I was thinking that sounds like the domain of a therapist or a psychologist. And now here you mention mental health. And I think, wow, I would have never guessed an OT for that. And I also wonder, where is the line or how do you distinguish? How do you know? I'm sure you'll say the answer is probably asking questions. But, you know, I was thinking, how do you know when an occupational therapist is the person I should consult versus a traditional therapist, I guess, for want of a better word? Is my challenge with making friends related to daily living that I need an OT, or is it related to something else that I need a psychologist? Mm-hmm. How do you know?
So the difference, I would say, is really based on the functional aspect, right? The real life aspect or the activities of daily living. If you want to investigate why is it that you're having socialization difficulties and understand, you know, kind of the stem, not just in your past, but also in who you are as a person, then it has a bit more of a cognitive twist to it. But if you're really looking for functional strategies to act on right now, to do, to make a difference now on your life, then that's more of the realm of the occupational therapist. The key word here is really activity, right? We're real life based. We're people who like to problem solve, find out strategies and do it.
So if an OT was going to help someone with making friends, and we'll say that due to your challenge or your inability to make friends, we're seeing that it's having an impact on your mental health and maybe you're feeling isolated, how would an OT help someone to make friends?
That's a really great question. So depending on why is it that this person is having trouble making friends, we'll be able to tailor strategies specific to that particular person and to that particular person's context as well. Right? If it's because you're not having enough opportunities to meet new people or you're not meeting people that are like you, we have all sorts of tests and questionnaires to identify what is it that drives you, what kind of interests do you have, And we're occupational therapists are usually very community-based as well. So we know a lot about different opportunities in the community, how you can get in touch with some people, how you can get involved. The idea is to use the activities to make your life more meaningful. So whether you like to do curling or you like to do, I don't know, basketball, whatever it is that you like to do, I don't have to be an expert in that, but I'm an expert in the community and in finding something that's going to resonate with you. And oftentimes by trial and error, we end up finding something that's going to make a difference. And we end up giving the tools that the person needs to be able to participate in those activities.
That is a great example. Thank you, Eliane. Do you have any closing thoughts?
That's a good question. I think we've kind of gone through a lot of the things that I had thought of ahead. But I did want to thank you, Nikita, for taking the time to have me on your podcast today and to be able to, again, have a public platform to share all of those things. The PhD life can be sometimes very isolating, and I'm always glad to have an opportunity to talk about these things and make sure that occupational therapy is being made aware of.
Well, I thank you, Eliane, very much for coming to the Good Health Cafe, for sharing your knowledge with our listeners, and for your general enthusiasm around the issues of occupational therapy. So thank you so much for being a guest today.
My pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed that episode. Some key takeaways were: 1, occupational therapists are rehabilitation professionals who help people that are having trouble with activities of daily living. 2, it's a good idea to interview the occupational therapist to see if they're going to be a good fit for your needs. And 3, referrals to occupational therapists for children often come from teachers or doctors. As usual, if you would like to learn more about the Good Health Cafe, check out our website, www.thegoodhealthcafe.com, follow us on social media, or sign up for our mailing list. And if you would like to learn more about Eliane, please check out her website. The link is in the show notes. Until next time, see you in the cafe later. Bye.